Welcome to Fermentality. I'm your host, Kat Pierce with Atlantic Brew Supply, and we're homebrewers talking homebrew and sharing fermentation.
All righty. Well, Julia, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. You are, I believe, our third or fourth guest on Fermentality. And so why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about your position with the American Homebrewers Association.
Awesome. And I'm honored to be in the company, Kat, of what you're doing. And Fermentality is growing in leaps and bounds. You're going to have a great body of work. I can't wait to watch it. It's progress and your progress. My name is Julia Herz, pronounced opposite of his is an easy way to remember it. And I'm the executive director of the American Homebrewers Association, which is the national not-for-profit trade group that represents the majority of homebrewers on the hobbyist side as the membership, national membership organization. We have 37,000 members. There's certainly millions of members. So when I say the majority of homebrewers, I mean, you know, homebrewers that are active and engaged and really want to expand their community through a national organization. I'm also a homebrewer, beer educator. I just started a podcast on beer styles called Sense of Beer Style, co-authored a book called Beer Pairing. And through my work at the Brewers Association, which is the parent organization to the American Homebrewers Association, I've worked on behalf of helping grow independent craft brewers for many years. So I've been around the block. I brewed a few batches of beer. I got one in front of me. Right here, I can talk about that. That was our Learn to Homebrew Day recipe from 2022, a hoppy amber ale. And I'm just excited to talk to you and learn from you too and connect with your listeners.
Excellent. Well, cheers. I actually did pour myself a smash beer that we made. Our purchasing agent was taking a look at some of the new hops that BSG had in and some hops that we hadn't tried yet. Ooh, gorgeous. And so we tried Nobility, and so Nobility is like a higher alpha acid saaz from what we found, and so just literally did 2-row and the Nobility and I believe WLP-001. So it came out super floral and spicy, and we dry hopped with it, so it's just like super fresh right now because we literally kegged it last week. But
well, and if you're we're in the hands of a very advanced professional, you're tossing around lingo, which is amazing. And I don't hear enough about smash beers, right? Single malt, single hop. Mm-hmm. So super fun, looks really pretty, and I hope it's great.
Well, you know, I have had a little bit of it, but I'm going to take a sip right now because it is absolutely fantastic. Cheers. Tell me about the AHA Amber Ale that you have there that you did for Learn to Homebrew Day.
Sure. American Homebrewers Association does annual homebrew holidays throughout each year. Big Brews coming up in May 2023, if you're listening to this before that date, and that'll be a whole different ballgame. We haven't announced the recipe yet, but that's the biggest batch of beer brewed, frankly, in the world at the same time every year, practically. And Learn to Homebrew Day is in November. That's what this beer was brewed for, and the Hoppy Amber Ale was designed, that recipe, to be really easy, really accessible for new homebrewers. So it's basically an extract batch with steeping grains. There was no conversion needed. Worked with my local homebrew shop, Mark from Bald Brewer out of Longmont, Colorado, and he helped confirm the recipe, as well as Zymergy Magazine and homebrewersassociation.org editors helped us get this dialed in along with the governing committee of the AHA. So when we do these annual homebrew holidays, and all the information is always on homebrewersassociation.org, we just want as many people as possible. Membership is not required to brew the recipes for these annual holidays, but we want as many people as possible to connect at different times of the year to help retailers like you, to help newbies that want to know how to enter the hobby. And if there are more people brewing in a common recipe, it's sometimes easier to wrap your bread around, your brain around, okay, I'm going to brew on this day and show people this recipe and get them to brew with me, support me, or me mentor them through this recipe. So that's Hoppy Amber Ale, and it's tasty.
Excellent. Yeah, we actually use one of the AHA Amber Ale, 3-gallon Amber Ale extract recipes for our Introduction to Homebrew Days. So we actually have one coming up on January 21st, and we specifically use that recipe because it also comes with the video. So, you know, in addition to having the recipe that we have as a kit online, we link that video so that way people can, you know, hopefully be able to have a little bit better of a time getting over those boundaries of lingo and all of that jazz. So
yeah, I think we have more than 50,000 views of that video. My coworker Millie is in that. She now works on the event side, and there's so many resources on homebrewersassociation.org. I don't even know if I could share screen while we're chatting. I could show you what you're talking about. But that's really cool. It's a resource for you all and helpful, because when you're the national org, you want world class. Like, we bring together world class educators. Homebrew Con's coming up in June, for example. More than 40 years of the national biggest gathering in the world for homebrewers, and we, you know, world class speakers are coming to that. And when we publish videos, or we're getting ready to launch a webinar series, we tap some of the best, and we mean it. And my heart is warmed when anyone uses the resources through Zymergy and homebrewersassociation.org. That's super cool to hear, Kat.
Excellent. So, speaking of homebrewing, when and how did you get into homebrewing? What exactly was it that sparked your interest?
Right. We all have our story, you know, and since I was little, before I was even 10, wasn't homebrewing then, but I was thinking about randomly different beers, different flavors, different producers, different packages, different styles, because my brother had a beer can collection. I grew up in Maryland, DC area. So my parents would drive us into the district from the Maryland suburbs to like support my brother's beer can collection from a restaurant that had more than 500 beers on the menu. So like, we're eating and drinking a couple times a year at this great restaurant, and like go down into a cellar. It was really dark. My parents were always in a really good mood. They'd start to like talk to the people next to them at the tables to give away some of the beer they were buying for my brother. And so it was a really positive experience when I was little about beer, right? And so I think I had beer on my radar, not just wine, because many women tend to skew towards wine based on marketing. But my family's approach wasn't that. It wasn't myopic in that way. So when I became of age, I homebrewed a Scottish ale from a kit with my friend Charlie Gunn, my young 20s, and I was hooked right from the get-go.
That's awesome that it's specifically that you mentioned a beer can collection. So my fiance was the one that actually ended up getting me like really, really big into beer. I had always been like, you know, interested in beer and enjoyed drinking it because I grew up with a family that loved visiting craft breweries, you know, and my dad also was born in Heidelberg, Germany. So, you know, he used to always talk about drinking beer in Germany and, you know, how fun that was. But my fiance likes to collect one can or bottle from every beer that he's drank. Mm-hmm. And of course, like throughout our move, when we purchased our first house, we're coming in with boxes and boxes of bottles and cans and things like that. I'm going, Alan, do you really need a can of Miller Lite? Like, I don't understand. And he's like, I have to have it. I have to have it. And so, you know, it's interesting. My uncle also collected beer cans and beer bottles. So it's really interesting that, you know, folks that are into this hobby and into this industry as a whole, that's kind of like, you know, something that everybody does a little bit of. Well, my next question for you is, what was it specifically about homebrewing that fascinated you and made you want to continue with the hobby? A lot of people, they start this hobby like any other hobby, and they get into it and they enjoy it for a short amount of time. And they're like, okay, I'm ready for the next hobby. So what was it that made it stick for you?
Right. Some people have hobbies that are lifetime hobbies, and others dabble and bounce around. For me, homebrewing really scratched the itch on multiple levels. One, on the sensory side. When I was little, Kat, I had like a soapbox collection. My dad would travel all around the world and bring me soaps from different hotels, and I'd keep it in these lunch boxes, and you'd open up the box and I just get hit with this combination of aroma. Is kind of like when you walk into a soap or a candle store and everything melds together in those smells. And so I was always interested in flavor, aroma, and that. And so, and cooking. And then when I came of age and was able to brew, it seemed like a natural fit to try. And then as I tried it, it taught me geography. It taught me about hedonics, which is my, you know, likes and dislikes, right? It taught me about science. It taught me chemistry. It taught me to tinker like a MacGyver. And a lot of the time growing up, I wasn't getting my hands dirty as many as the boys around me in the like the wood shop and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So it taught me all these things that took me to a place of growth, right? And then it also brought me community. I would hand somebody my beer and like, wow, what a much more impactful connection we would have. Somebody would hand me their beer and wow, I was going to remember the fact that they thought to give me their beverage that they brewed. So it gave me so many things. And I think that's why I've always stuck with it. Certainly everyone doesn't make a career out of it. You know, American Homebrewers Association of those 37,000 members, and we hope everyone is one. A good large proportion have indicated they want to go pro, but most won't, right? The majority of us homebrewers don't go pro. And so it also, homebrewing reminds me to have fun. Like I work in beer and I never want to take it too seriously. So the homebrewing in me lets me innovate. Another beer I've recently brewed is a Belgian Golden Session Ale with wild plums, right? Instead of a Baltic Porter, I turned a Baltic Porter into a Baltic Red with choke cherries that I sourced right out my backyard. So homebrewing lets me go to places that the beers I'm going to buy from the amazing craft brewers out there, they're never going to take me to the places that I can take myself from what I forage and what I have in my, you know, my kitchen cabinet or spice cabinet.
Awesome. Yeah, that's one of the things that I try and really, you know, get people thinking about. You know, BJCP style guidelines are there for a reason, right? But in the same breath, it's fun to be able to like play with them and, you know, break those boundaries a little bit, which is, you know, in the commercial industry, I feel like that is really picked up over in the past like 10 years where they're like pushing those boundaries as far as they can. But I mean, at home, you know, you can create your own style. Like, you know, you, for example, I was chatting with some ladies that are homebrewers with me and we're wanting to do a beer together and we want to do hibiscus and orange peel in there, yes. But then we want to use an English yeast and have it still be like, have a good malt backbone to it. But the problem was, is that we're like, okay, let's do a, like a Vienna lager or like an English dark mild, but we also want to showcase the pretty color of the hibiscus. So, you know, we're sitting here going, okay, well, what base style can we use? Forget the base style, just brew it, you know, just put it, what we want in there and focus on the sensory. And if you make a good beer that you enjoy drinking, you're homebrewed, you know?
Very well said. Yes. Your styles matter to the point of communication and a sense of understanding if you want to dial in your ability to land at a certain sensory profile and a spectrum within that profile that's documented in the style guidelines. It's very valuable for that, right? Style guidelines definitely have a value. But when we go to the ice cream store, we don't talk style. We say what flavor.
Yeah.
and then in store, it's like the only style is flavor. And then everything else is its own individual thing. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the reasons specifically why I got into homebrewing. And, you know, some of the more technical homebrewers that I know, they're always like, Kat, you know, what base style are you using, you know, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, listen, for me, what defines a homebrewer is if you can answer yes to both of these questions. One, did you have fun making it? And number two, did you enjoy drinking it? You know, if you can answer yes to both of those, you're a homebrewer, you know, but I also understand everybody gets into homebrewing for different reasons. You know, some people really love the technical side to where they want to play with all the new gadgets and toys. And then some people get into it for sensory or cooking reasons, or some people just really like watching the airlock bubble. I mean, but speaking of equipment, what equipment did you start with and what do you use now to homebrew?
Definitely just started with what was in my kitchen with a few little bells and whistles ordered from any of the, at today, at least 600 plus homebrew shops, a lot less probably when I started brewing in my 20s, but I didn't have an airlock on hand, for example, right? he needed a few key things. I didn't have sanitizer. I had bleach. I probably used bleach. So my main homebrewing equipment was the kettle from making stocks and soups in my kitchen and the long spoon that fits into that kettle. So I pretty much had everything on hand. It was easy enough to start with that 5-gallon extract batch, based on what I was able to get out of the gates. That was a one and done. You know, I didn't feel like I had a barrier, with equipment to then hold up my ability to brew a first batch of beer.
Nice. So what is it that you use now?
Oh boy, that's a different evolution. As I said, I brewed a few batches. I mean, I probably brewed more than 100 plus batches.
Wow.
I am in my era of not working at the Brewers Association or the AHA. My husband and I have won a silver medal for old ale at the National Homebrew Competition.
Wow.
Like pretty tough style to make, or medal in. I've done everything from brewed in this, you asked what, but I'm saying where to get to the what. I've done everything from brewed in my 1950s lodgepole pine cabin, outside of my town of Nederland, Colorado. Right now I'm talking to you in Lyons, Colorado. But up the hill, up in the mountains, about an hour is Nederland. So I had a small cabin with my husband, and we would brew on the patio with Cajun cookers and larger kettles. So we had a mash tun and a boil kettle. I brewed in my other home after that was an authentic adobe style home. Same style on the patio, not stovetop as much. I brewed a lot of stovetop beers though, extract purely extracting steeping grains. I've done a Mr. Beer kit. And then I've done all grain for sure, outside, with like 10 gallon kettles, and a mash tun, and then a hot liquor tank on the side. I'm getting ready to do electric brew in one system. So I'm excited to try that.
Nice.
And I brewed 1 gallon all grain, on my camper, my in and out stove on my A-liner camper, where you can plug it inside the camper next to the sink, or you can plug it outside. It's fueled by propane. I brewed a 1 gallon batch of beer. That was last year. The 1 gallon all grain that I brewed on that camper stove was that Belgian Golden Stress Session with Wild Plums. And that's like my favorite beer lately that I want to perfect. So I'm definitely interested in learning all levels of how everyone homebrews. So I'm not the best to say, I just do this and dial it in. Because, you know, to grow the hobby of homebrewing, to grow AHA membership, to grow the hobby, I need to understand intimately what everyone is doing. And maybe as people listen to this show, they can leave in the comments when you publish it, like what their brew system is. Do they plan to stay with it, or do they plan to grow into something else? And all of us have a different story to that same question, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I started with the brew in a bag. And it's funny because a lot, you know, most people typically start out with extract. Mm-hmm. And I think we did, My fiance did one extract brew, and I just happened to watch him do it. And then later on, once I started working in the commercial industry, I was like, I want to really learn how to do all grain because I want to understand the brewing process better. So that way I'm a better sales rep. Right. And so I ended up doing brew in a bag to start out with, and did that for a couple of years, and bottled for a couple of years and moved into kegging. But eventually I moved into the mash and boil, which was like the all-in-one electric. And I love it. I really, really wish that I had just started out with that. But, you know, I was afraid that I wasn't going to, you know, keep up with this hobby. Cause, as a previous boss of mine used to say, you know, I'm a serial hobbyist. So sometimes, you know, I pick up a certain hobby and it just doesn't stick, but thankfully homebrewing did. But I mean, yeah, like you can see, I do stained glass as well.
Wow.
I do stained glass as well. So, you know, it's one of those things that I was afraid it wouldn't stick, but, the mash and boil is definitely my absolute favorite, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you brought up a lot. Think about skiing, right? You take or snowboarding, you buy or you rent at first, right? The equipment, but then that's a sport hobby. And over the years, if you invest in equipment that's more customized to your physical size, that's more aligned with the type and style of downhilling you want to do, then you are off and running. And so, you know, any hobby can be as inexpensive as less than $100 to get started, which definitely is homebrewing, to, wow, I'm going to do this more often. So I'm actually going to invest in equipment, and that's going to up my game and my ability to make even higher, you know, quality beers that are more expansive and different arrays of results. That's the barrier that some people maybe just don't get to in their head when they just start homebrewing. And the next thing you know, they're purchasing and they need space to put it in. And it's all these considerations. But that to me is the indicative situation or conversation that one has for any hobby. What am I going to invest in to grow my ability to do this? Because I love doing it. And that's the fun of asking people like me and you, like, what equipment do you use? Because it's not the same from day one to the last time you ever brew. And everybody, there's no one right way to homebrew too.
Yeah, you're speaking to my soul when you mentioned skiing, because I actually do ski patrol with the National Ski Patrol.
Wow.
I am a previous I'm an alumni of Beach Mountain Ski Patrol in North Carolina. So, you know, you living in Colorado, though, obviously you've got a lot better snow. But yeah, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people are afraid of, too, trying to get into this hobby, thinking like, oh, no, this is going to be so expensive. And, you know, some people get into the hobby specifically for saving money. They don't have to go out and purchase things. But then I feel like, just like any hobby, once you get into it, it starts to burn a hole in your pocket if you thoroughly enjoy it. But there, you don't have to. I mean, I have a Spike 5-gallon fermenter, but I still use buckets, you know? Right. I've gotten to the point now where I really only use glass carboys for mead. You know, I really, really thoroughly enjoy being able to just have the convenience of dropping my wort into a bucket as soon as I open the ball valve. I mean, that's, to me, it's all about convenience sometimes.
Yeah, my husband just started as kind of a hobby, homemade yogurt, right? And I'm watching him progress and like ordering new things to bring them in the house. And it's this equipment investment that's helping him kind of grow and experiment and try. And what we do on the national level, I mean, besides try to advance the hobby so more people enjoy it and thus they can grow individually, grow professionally, whatever your goals are, homebrewing can help you reach those because of you practice the hobby. But we also try to offset costs, right? Discounts, member deals. American Homebrewers Association offers more than 2,000 exclusive member deals. We just launched an exclusive one with Cicerone. If you are a member of the AHA, you get 20% off of their study materials, including Beer Savvy software that lets you sit for the first level Cicerone. That's very significant. And with homebrew shops, right? I mean, there's discounts, 2,000 plus, to try to offset those costs. That's the benefit of being a part of a collective org. When you invest your dollars, you should be paying whoever you want for that content. There's so many amazing magazines out there, including Zymergy that we publish. So I just love the fact that we are trying to offset the cost so the membership fees pay for themselves, the equipment fees over time can pay for themselves. If you're saving money, frankly, on what you're brewing, that's a win, right?
Absolutely. I mean, at Atlantic Brew Supply for in-store customers, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't apply to online orders, but if you shop locally with us and come into the shop and purchase something and you're an AHA member, then you get a 5% discount. So, you know, there are definitely ways of getting into this hobby and making it more financially feasible. But yeah, so I guess speaking of equipment, you know, we talked about all different ways that we can, you know, either improve our equipment or do things that make it a little more convenient for us, but convenience is my favorite topic. What is one piece of equipment you cannot live without?
Well, convenience to me is having, when you homebrew, the guarantee that from start to finish, no matter what touch that liquid, it didn't influence it with unwanted microorganisms and agents that were not intended to be an ingredient in the beer. So I'm certainly going to say my sanitation solutions, and I have multiple ones we all likely do, and what we purchase for those, for our equipment, for you know, the minerals. You use one form of sanitation for mineral, beer stone, calcium oxalate, all that, compared to what microorganisms you need to make sure are not existing. So you want to wash those out with a good wash of a reliable sanitizer. So my, I know it's kind of boring and geeky, but my sanitizer solution, and again, back to there's no rinse and there's rinse, and people can truly use bleach. Charlie Papazian, who founded the American Homebrewers Association, still to this day, and frankly, he's 20 minutes outside that window. I have been in his brew house many, many times. He still uses bleach.
Wow. Right? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. You know, it's funny because you mentioned sanitizer, and I mean, like, sanitizer is such a nerdy response, and I love it because I really get along well with nerds because I'm one myself. But you know, for me, thinking about sanitation specifically, I can't live without my spray bottle. Like, I love having a spray bottle filled with sanitizer. I mean,
totally get it. You're speaking to my heart, and you're speaking to the choir. Like, where's the spray bottle? It's not just where's the sanitizer. It's where's the spray bottle with the sanitizer, because it's just so much easier to apply. And then you're ready. And that's those time-saving tips that are my favorite things. The more you brew the same recipe or tweak that recipe, but it's the same and you're just evolving it, the more you brew with your same equipment, you are getting more efficient on your brew day. Then your weekend or weeknight is a little lighter for time. And that's very nice. I mean, many people don't want to speed through their hobby activities. It's about that Zen practice of relaxing and just kind of getting into it and thinking about anything but your day-to-day work or life. And that's cool too. But if you want to save time, the sanitizer spray bottle, I want to use that answer next time.
Yeah. All right. So I know you had mentioned the fact that you happen to homebrew while you're camping. You talked about the equipment that you use, but what advice do you have for people that like might want to do that, homebrew while they're camping, whether they have a camper or not?
Absolutely. Most recent issue of Zymergy magazine is here.
I've got it right behind me.
And the issue, look at the little sweet people. It's such a gorgeous pub. I know there's a little glare there. There's little people on a beer glass, right? That's to represent the theme of the issue is small batch brewing. Dan Jablo did one of the best, and he's mentored me on getting going on 1 gallon all grain batches.
Oh,
so
wow.
If you get Zymergy, that article tells you soup to nuts what you need to do. And the reason I say that is my answer is because if you're going to brew, as you're bringing up, it was a 1 gallon all grain, meaning you did need to convert those grains, convert starches to sugars and create an enzymatic reaction versus just extract brewing, which everything's ready except for the hop isomerization that still needs boiling. But you want to really practice, and you practice on your stovetop to get ready to camp on your camper stove if you're me. And that really helped. Make sure you have the right size kettle. If you're camping, sometimes water is an issue, so make sure you have enough water on hand. When I was brewing in Wyoming for the Belgian Golden Session with Wild Plums, the day before I brewed, I spoke to a bunch of Wyoming brewers who were there for the Wyoming Craft Brewers Guild, and I was at the hotel, but in my camper in the back instead of staying inside. And the day I gave my talk and like dangled to all of them, like, hey, I'm here to say, pro brewers, you should still be homebrewing because it advances your knowledge. It keeps your synapses firing. It keeps you innovating. It helps your career, all of that. And I'm like, and by the way, tomorrow I'll be outside in the back of the parking lot in my camper brewing. So come check it out. And they were like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then I'm like, and it's a 1 gallon all grain. And they were all like, oh my gosh, I got to totally check this out. And the point of me sharing that is on the Thursday when I spoke, the weather was great. I was literally moving the camper. It was so hot to find shade during different times of the day.
Oh, wow.
And then there was a 40 degree swing. And so the next day it was freezing and I had to brew inside the camper for part of the brew. So getting ready to think about plan B when you're brewing on your camper because you're outside in the elements is always a good idea too. And so I just knew how to take the stove that was connected to the propane on the outside of my camper and move it. And take a few things off the countertop and put the stove on the inside and plug it to the propane there. And I started brewing inside.
What a way to convince nerds. Like, people, commercial brewers are inherently nerdy too, right? They had to start somewhere. And then you say, oh, by the way, it's a 1 gallon all grain.
Yeah. And my point really was, you don't have to brew it on your camper, but I was trying to show them on any stove, including your stovetop at home, whether it's electric or gas, I want you all thinking home brewing. I want you using the resources that are out there through the American Homebrewers Association, through all the online forums, through so many people that contribute to this industry, this community of businesses. I mean, we have 2,000 plus homebrew clubs on homebrewersassociation.org, 600 plus retail shops. There's a big community built to not just grow craft brewing through the allied trade and the incredible partners that build equipment and provide ingredients, but the retailers and the homebrew clubs are really there to help each other. And I mean, pro brewers should remember that entire ecosystem is there for them to play in a sandbox that doesn't worry about dollars and cents as much, but can literally bring you to that next great flagship beer that saves your brewery. I mean, there's so much to do, and I'm sure you're aware of that day in and day out, being a part of the homebrew supply shop side.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I think for me, what's interesting is that I have interviewed, you know, when I was working in the commercial industry, I interviewed a couple of folks for a head brewer position in addition to assistant brewer positions. And throughout those interviews, one of the things that these folks were saying were like, you know, I didn't have the opportunity to be creative in my last job. Like, we had to be so focused on producing and getting the beer out and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, well, do you homebrew? You know? And I mean, I get it. Sometimes if you're brewing all day, the last thing you want to do when you go home is, you know, brew more beer. But in the same breath, like, if you're concerned about not having the opportunity to be creative, what a great way to be creative and use your ability to and knowledge from commercial brewing into that. I mean, one of the guys that I just hired in the homebrew shop, like, he was a commercial brewer out in Florida for a little while. And he just came in and I said, you know, you're a commercial brewer. What makes you interested in the homebrew shop? And he says, well, I was homebrewing while I was still working in commercial because it helped me with that creativity. But I realized that really what I wanted was an opportunity to be creative as a result of homebrewing, which is why I want to work in the homebrew shop. And that to me was like music to my ears. You know, I love hearing that, and I love having somebody so knowledgeable on my team, but also somebody that, excuse my language, gives a shit. You know, he wants to be involved in beer, and that's what makes him a great employee for my shop, in addition to his extensive knowledge and his passion, you know. I love asking people this question because I've gotten a lot of really hilarious stories, including exploding fermentation vessels and, you know, drilled rubber stoppers shooting out and then having a beer shower or whatever. But what is one mistake that you have made, or what is the biggest mistake that you've made while homebrewing, and what did you learn from it?
Well, biggest and one are two very different answers. And so as you're asking, setting up the question, my mind goes to many a scene in my internal tapes of being in the garage and cursing at myself, or being in the bathroom, wherever I would be cleaning things. I mean, when you learn to brew, you're dealing with equipment. Sometimes the equipment and the gaskets don't seal, or they're old. And I mean, I've had full kegs leak into my, you know, cooler. That's a side placed refrigerator that is a converted chest freezer. And you open the door and there's 5 gallons no longer in the keg, but instead in the bottom of that cooler. Like, you know, yeah, that's a sad day, but it's also a good lesson of you want integrity behind the equipment you're working with. So you have to really check for all those little locations that microorganisms can fester. Do replace gaskets on a regular basis. Make sure that when you seal something and then hook it up to carbon dioxide or CO2, that you listen to see if anything's hissing. Use your great spray bottle to see if there's any leaks and things, because bubbles will showcase themselves if you have a spray bottle of soapy water and CO2 is leaking out. So I think the biggest mistakes I've probably made have been with kegging. Then there's the occasional boil over, right? Where you're just not watching. One time I had a wort chiller, which is, for those that are listening and don't know or watching, it's this coiled, circular, curved thing that's layered. Think of a snake or a slinky, and you place that into your beer, and then on one end you hook up cold water, and on the other end the cold water comes out, and it basically, that chiller cools your batch of beer, so then it gets to a temperature that you can connect the yeast. We were at my Adobe house then. Of course, I'm wort chilling, I get everything hooked up, I place the wort chiller in, 5-gallon batch. So it takes time for that to cool, as you know, 20 minutes, even longer sometimes if it's summer out and the well water's not as cool. And I come back and the wort chiller had a split in it. So the chiller of all the times. And so I just had this like diluted, watered down, no more could find where the wort had gone and the water had come in, batch of beer, and I lost it because I stepped away to do a few emails while I was just telling myself it would chill. So it teaches you diligence too in some of the disasters. You know, when I'm transferring now, it's like if you work with fish and you're changing the water, don't go do those emails. What if you forget and then the fish have no water because you're transferring out the old water? You need to be present to what you're doing. And that's why I have less accidents today.
Very good. That is a very unfortunate set of circumstances with your wort chiller. I have definitely had a few of those, more specifically, like you had mentioned with kegging. I had done a apricot pre-mail. And it was absolutely delicious. We used a thiolized yeast, which is essentially a yeast that helps with, you know what a thiolized yeast is, but for our listeners, it's a yeast that helps bring out really like tropical like flavors with hops. And so we use Nelson Sauvin, which is a Australian hop or New Zealand hop anyway, but it has this really nice, gorgeous tropical flavor and went really well with the apricot. And that beer was fantastic. And we had put that into the keg, but there was still some puree up in suspension. And there is a tube on the inside of the keg called our dip tube, right? That brings the beer from the bottom of the keg to the top and through your faucet and allows you to pour it out. Well, I used this same keg later on and for a gorgeous Irish red that my coworker and I had put together. He came over and we, you know, made a whole day out of making this beer that was absolutely beautiful. And so I brought it to the shop, the keg to the shop, and even it had poured great for a couple of days. And then all of a sudden it just wasn't pouring at all. And we're like, what the heck? What's going on? And, you know, I thought that I had cleaned all of this and there was no trub or gunk that I had taken from my fermenter over to my keg. What is the issue? Pull out the dip tube and the top of the dip tube right around the poppet was just clogged with all kinds of what I can only assume to be puree from the previous beer. And I'm going, man, did I really need, like, I thought I cleaned the heck out of this. Like, what's going on? It was so frustrating. But yeah, I would say for me, kegging is the most, is where I've had the majority of my, my mistakes.
Yeah.
So what is a brew that you have made at any point in time that you're most and or especially proud of?
I really did like the previously mentioned, instead of Baltic Porter, and it was a happy homebrew accident, but the Baltic Choke Cherry Red.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that came to be, and I'll tell you, it was gorgeous. It was a lagered Baltic Porter too, because Baltic Porter, you can use ale yeast or lager yeast. And the choke cherries brought this red hue to it. I just classic homebrew mistake in the shop, I guess, neglected when I was getting my specialty malts maybe to do the right ratio. So it wasn't, I didn't have as much darker roasted malts. That's why it was more of a Baltic red, at least in my spin. And then the choke cherries just brought it to that rust place. They brought some nice tannins to the table. Choke cherries, if you've ever worked with them, are really tart. And so to bring all that, like pretend you have like a Doppelbock. Doppelbock's getting more towards the Baltic red, right? It's definitely not a Baltic porter, but the same like body and weight. And then you add like pomegranate, cranberry, or choke cherry juice to it. It will really please me. And I made that for a movie I got to be in, beermovie.org. Amazing, gorgeous movie. Still can be viewed today. Frederick Moser shot that movie and he paired me up with a brewer who was in Vienna, Christoph from a brewery called Bierall. In Austria, not Vienna. And Christoph and I were collaborating, but he went dark like 2 weeks before we were supposed to brew together at my home here. And so I had to construct the recipe. And then I think I also at the shop just didn't dial it in enough with the Nutch roasted malt, but it was a very happy accident.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. Yeah. I am really big into like beers with stone fruit. Like that's just, and especially something that's like slightly tart. There's a reason Flanders Red is my absolute favorite beer style.
Oh, very nice style. Love Flanders Reds. Yes.
I just brewed one for the first time about 6 or 7 months ago that I'm getting ready for my wedding in October. So
nice. Congratulations. It's so fun.
So, you know, hopefully it's not a flop. If not, I'll just go get some Rodenbach and we'll be fine. All right. So as an award-winning homebrewer and BJCP certified judge, I think you are also an advanced Cicerone. Is that true?
Correct.
What advice do you have for homebrewers interested in entering a homebrew competition?
This is an age-old question, and homebrew competitions truly, I think, are an incredible way to test your skills. Also, if you want to be on the competition side of judging or stewarding, it's a great way to test your sensory side, not just your brewing prowess if you're an entrant, say, to that competition. I would say, A, don't be scared to enter the local one down the street and the national one that we host, National Homebrew Competition, right? You want to compete with a variety of people. And when you enter your homebrew competition, you want to pay attention as a judge. I just judged big beers, Belgians, and barley wines this past weekend as an example. Mm. When we get the beer served to us, we really want the entrant to have paid attention to the instructions. So that's not a handicap against you out of the gates. So just read all the rules and regs. Make sure you fill out on your entry form everything that competition is asking for. If they indicate you're supposed to state specialty ingredients based on style guidelines, state the specialty ingredients. And really read the style guidelines. And another big one that is not my great tip, but I use it because it's obvious and it works, is don't enter the style you want your beer to win in or medal in. Enter the style that you think you brewed. In other words, sometimes I might have brewed a strong Burton style ale, but it's really more of an ESB. Right. So you, when you brew, before you enter that competition, if you're able to test it against the guidelines, do your own sample competition and see what the judges are. And then you know better where to enter that actual beer. That's a definite, definite big tip.
Oh, yeah. That is one that I always, always recommend, you know, being able to actually use sensory analysis to determine where your beer best fits. So thank you. I appreciate that. You know, everyone has something a little bit different to recommend for new homebrewers. But speaking of advice, once again, what advice do you have for folks interested in starting the hobby?
I would say, definitely homebrewersassociation.org has a lot of free resources, not even required to be a member. But so go there, learn the hobby from just like videos, and maybe go join a homebrew club or drop into a local homebrew club meeting, because first meetings, you don't have to be a member. They're always into recruiting and they want you to check out the club. Go see what the club is about or ask if you can brew with some club members from one of those 2,000 plus homebrew clubs in the US. to go to your local homebrew shop and go to an introduction to homebrewing class. There's a lot of classes that are practical. I mean, this year for National Homebrew Competition and HomebrewCon, that'll be in San Diego, June 22nd to 24th, we'll have workshops. And those workshops will be hands-on, beginning homebrewing and advanced homebrewing. You can also do it online. So I would just say, start talking to others. And then tap your experts or your guides and your mentors based on who makes the most sense to you to connect with, and have others show you. The other total side approach is just get a kit, brew it in your house, and stumble along from there, and make sure you brew more than once. Because if you just try it once alone, you have a lot to learn. And that's a great way to start, but you want to make sure you hold yourself accountable to give the true diligence to it. You want to brew 3 or 4 or 5 times, and then you're going to start to know how to really get a batch done properly.
Absolutely. So why, you mentioned AHA and all of the benefits from AHA, but if you were to choose, a couple of reasons why should homebrewers become a member of the American Homebrewers Association?
Sure. And as I said, we have close to 37,000 members. We've helped millions of people over the years brew. We helped establish the entire craft beer movement. American Homebrew Association has been around since 1978. I've been your executive director for 1 year now. I started first as a member, though, to the AHA. And so I would say it honestly, where as soon as I started getting Zymergy magazine that we published since 1978, and we still publish it today, Zymergy comes to you every other month as part of your membership, and it gives you a reminder and reasons and rewards and ways to homebrew. So I would say why is because, yes, you absolutely can homebrew without being a part of your national organization. But if you want to contribute to the collective community and gain from the collective community, as soon as you become a member for less than $50 a year, you tap into the exclusive resources of world top of class education, exclusive member benefits for discounts, member deals that you can't get anywhere else. You get Zymergy magazine, you get access to National Homebrew Competition gold medal winning recipes. We have 1400 plus recipes on homebrewersassociation.org. And the list goes on and on from there. But I would say that's enough. If you wanted just a small little reason to up your game each year, make sure to have AHA membership on your list.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So this is another fun one that I like to ask people and close with, just because I enjoy seeing what everybody has to say. But if you had to pick your favorite type of fermentable beverage to make and drink, what would it be?
Well, isn't the answer beer? What do you mean? How do I answer it? Besides, I mean, I love mead. I'm dabbling in cider. Like, is what are you looking for in the answer? To me, it's beer, unless I'm supposed to. Is it a trick question?
So actually, I thought that was the last one. And the last question was the fun one. But so I messed up on that.
All good.
But so if you had to pick your favorite type of fermentable beverage to make and drink, it would be beer.
Yes.
Very good. I would have to say the same thing, just because, beer is where I initially started. But since starting with the homebrew shop, I have really gotten into mead and also really into learning how to make seltzer. Like, I thought seltzer was going to be so easy, and then I realized that is not the case. And it's interesting hearing from people that started out with beer and then started learning more about other aspects of fermentation, what their favorite thing is. But I definitely feel like
I love your answer, Kat, and I just want to contribute to what you're sharing with the listeners. It's an interesting one that you bring up mead, because I used to have a website, honeywine.com. I had a lot of investment over the years to help contribute to the mead community. And there's a big difference to me, and I love them both, between beer and mead. Mead, I don't want to muddle it and say just like grape wine, but if you don't have a reference to fermented honey, that's think of grape juice and now think of honey, and they both become wine. Mead is from honey being fermented and diluted. Honey is like white paint to me.
White paint. Oh, no.
Yeah, this is no, in a good way, not flavor wise. Hang with me.
Okay.
Honey First of all, there's so many varietals. If the Beer Judge Certification Program has a very robust Mead Judge Certification Program with a great syllabus that's an incredible document to read and learn from. And it talks about, you know, there's 100 plus varietals of honey. But the white paint thing is honey's ready to be converted. It's already sugar ready for the yeast, right? And as soon as you dilute honey enough, then the yeast can access the sugars in that honey. Honey is traditionally 17% water, give or take, but you have to dilute it more or else it won't ferment. That's how honey stays stable in nature. Beer is different. Beer and its 100 plus styles, it is fermented malted barley or malted grains. And that's not white paint. When I say white paint for honey, the delicate nature of those 100 plus varietals of honey, as soon as you take anything, fruit, yeast, any influence to that, even the water profile that you're diluting that honey with, the white is no longer white. There's just no denying it, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard to make mead because you want to fight to have this showcase the honey that you're using. Malted barley has to be then converted. That's the barley getting malted and then diluted. So the sugars have an enzymatic reaction to be accessible to the yeast to ferment and create alcohol and CO2. That's a totally different proposition than mead. So I love them both. But I think in a more complex, challenging me way, even though it's harder to make good mead, in my view, than it is harder to make good beer, it's more challenging on the beer side to construct a recipe and work your way through with the different equipment than making the mead.
Perfectly stated. That's, you know, I don't think I could have said it better than better myself. So here is the question that I enjoy asking everyone to end the podcast with, just to see what people have to say. But if you were a style of beer, what would you be and why?
I don't want to answer extra special bitter because that makes it seem like I'm bitter. But I love extra special bitters. So if I were a style of beer, I wouldn't be a specific style. You know, different days, I have different moods, different days, you see different sides of my personality. So I'd be my, you know, Baltic Chokecherry Red or my Belgian Golden Session with wild plums. Like, I wouldn't be a style. I would be myself. That's my answer, Kat, and I'm sticking to it.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, it's difficult. It's funny. I've asked that question to so many people and I still can't even think of what my answer would be. So, but I like your answer. I really do. Cause I mean, you know, it's like we were saying earlier, you know, BJCP styles are there for a reason, but in the same breath, like, why not be your own style? You know, why not create a beer that you're going to enjoy making and enjoy drinking? And therefore be a homebrewer. All right, Julia. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. And I really look forward to this podcast coming out here in the next couple of months. We have our first release date set for the third Wednesday of January. So I will let you know when we get this actually posted. And I look forward to hopefully being able to chat with you again soon.
Fantastic, Kat. Keep up the great work. Cheers and good beers to everyone listening. And thank you all. Good beers to everybody. And what a neat treat to get to connect. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Fermentality and that this conversation inspires you to brew your best.